history through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are a few things we all have in common. One, we know that our freedom is not free. It is bought and paid for by those men and women in uniform who are willing to risk it all. And we also know that really, no matter where you are, there are some incredible stories just waiting to be told. It might be your next door neighbor, maybe one of your parents or grandparents, but we're just never going to know unless we take the initiative to ask a few questions and take the time to listen. That's what I've had the privilege of doing for well over a decade now, and I can't imagine my life without the perspective I've gained from these incredible Americans. The idea here is to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice, to preserve their stories so we never forget that price has been paid for our freedom. And along that journey, we end up not only educated, but entertained, and so often inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. It is, of course, Memorial Day weekend, and you could say that almost every episode is a Memorial Day episode when we hear from these World War II veterans about the friends they lost in combat. We're going to hear some of that today, but there's going to be a little different twist as well. First, let's talk about what Memorial Day is and what it isn't, because inevitably there's some confusion. Veterans Day in November honors all of those who have served, but the roots of Memorial Day go back to the Civil War and what was then called Decoration Day, a chance to decorate the graves of men who had died in uniform. The term Memorial Day was first used in 1882. It was observed on May 30th until 1971, when a new federal law moved it to the final Monday of May each year to enable a three-day weekend. Memorial Day is quite simply a day to remember the more than 1 million Americans dating back to the War for Independence who have given what President Lincoln called their last full measure of devotion to secure and preserve our freedom. It's a day to support those Gold Star families who have lost a son or daughter in the service by letting them know that that supreme sacrifice will never be forgotten. Many of the veterans we've met here over the years were part of Gold Star families themselves. They lost fathers, brothers, even sons to war. And if you can bear with me for just a minute in order to demonstrate how this is an issue that can touch so many of us and we're more connected to it than we probably think, I'd like to share how this program you're listening to, that some of you have been listening to for over a decade, can be traced back to one Gold Star family in the Midwest a century ago. My inspiration in this effort has always been my grandfather, Dr. Robert Leffler. He was a battalion surgeon attached to the 6th Armored Division in World War II. He happened to be the ranking medical officer at the liberation of the Buchenwald concentration camp. That was after he was awarded a Bronze Star during the Battle of the Bulge, and that was after he was recognized with the Silver Star for an incident near Pont-Orson, France, where he and his Jeep driver continued to go back into the line of fire to rescue men from burning tanks and half-tracks. He was one of the very first veterans I interviewed all those years ago, and I asked him what was going through his mind during that ordeal in which he saved 26 men.
I was pretty sure I was going to get killed.
Well, I'm glad you didn't.
Yeah, you wouldn't be around.
That response has stuck with me all these years, a sobering reminder that I would have never been born. That has implications for so many families with parallel stories, and it also has implications for those Gold Star families we should all keep in our prayers this weekend. What kind of lives would these fallen heroes have lived? What kind of impact would they have had? And how many descendants of theirs might have been world changers in their own right? And shouldn't that really motivate the rest of us to live in such a way that the value of freedom matches the price that was paid for it? And you know, that was where my grandfather's motivation came from. He had grown up hearing stories of his uncle, Vincent Duscheck, a brilliant University of Illinois engineering graduate from Wisconsin who was one of the first American military pilots ever. He flew de Havilland DH-4s in combat in Europe for over a year and even trained other fledgling pilots there in World War I. But on October 16, 1918, 26 days before the armistice to end World War I would be signed, whether he was shot down or it was some kind of accident is not clear, but that 23-year-old pioneering pilot was killed as his plane came down in a fiery crash in France. My grandfather was just 2 years old when that happened, but his uncle's story inspired him to join the Army before World War II. And as I said, it was his service that motivated me to try to preserve these stories and encourage others to do the same. In October, we will mark 100 years since my great-great-uncle Vincent Dushek made that ultimate sacrifice. But I have a little different idea for the rest of our time together today. I was thinking about some of the veterans who've left us over the last year since last Memorial Day, and that this would be an appropriate time to honor and remember their legacies. In listening back over some of their stories, it struck me how almost every single one of them shared about the brave Americans they knew in the war who never had the chance to come home. We're going to start with Al Skerritt, who passed away October 4th at the age of 97. That was less than a week after his interview aired here on Hometown Heroes, when he explained some of what he went through on the aircraft carrier USS Bunker Hill on May 11th, 1945, when more than 400 of his shipmates were killed in action.
We shot down one kamikaze and the other two hit the ship. I knew where they had hit because I could hear on my earphones what happened. Oh, I heard this pounding on this escape hatch, and it was from the engine room, and I opened up the escape hatch, and here there was a sailor. He was rum-dumb, and he wanted to get out, and I tried to help him out, but he was too heavy, and so I saw another sailor walking by, and I asked him to come over and help me, and he helped me get this guy out of this escape hatch. And this sailor told me, he says, you know, he says, there's a first aid station now in the forward part of the ship. I could take this guy up there. And I said, oh, please do. And I gave this guy to take up to the first aid station. Oh, this officer was there, and I heard this pounding on this here hatchway. I wanted to open up this gangway, and this officer was there. He says, don't you touch that. He says, we're to keep everything locked down. And we heard this pounding, and I wanted to open it because there was somebody on the other side wanting to get out. When we did open it, it was a terrible sight. There was a pile of, not just a few guys, but there was guys piled on top of one another. They'd come to the end of the driveway. I guess they couldn't see, but they had an object to climb over, and then they'd die on top. But we did open the door, the hatchway. There was a pile of sailors dead, not just one or two, but I would say there was five or six on top of one another trying to get further on.
And so people understand, you wanted to open it because you know there's someone there, but they wouldn't let you because of the fire risk? Was that the issue?
Or the explosion.
So you could, by trying to save them, you could kill a whole bunch more?
Yes, the officer wouldn't let me open up that hatch until things quieted down.
Did you ever, in all those years, think back to that guy you'd pulled out of the engine room on the Bunker Hill and wonder what happened to him?
Of course I thought about that, but it would only be a moment thought. It was really surprising when I got that phone call here at the house.
So about a decade ago, you talked to a writer, Max Kennedy, son of Robert F. Kennedy, who was writing a book about the Bunker Hill and that tragedy. So your story's in that book.
Yes.
And unbeknownst to you, there's a gentleman in Chicago reading that book.
Yeah, well, he called me, and he told me that I was the guy that pulled him out of the hole. He says he didn't know. He always wondered who I was until I don't know what took him so long to read this book about that Maxwell Kennedy wrote. But it was surprising. I feel real good that I know the guy that I saved. I really did save him. But I was young and I was strong and I wasn't emotional like I am now. And I do think about all the different friends of mine that got killed. I feel like even though I'm still here, I feel like I'm still on a mission. Maybe my mission is just to show gratitude and also to tell my story. I even think it's quite a story. Yeah.
When you think about all those sailors on your ship that died in that attack. How should we remember them now? What's their legacy? What do we need to know about them or remember about them?
I think it would be good to show pictures of that time, to know about them, how they buried them at sea and all that. And I really feel like they should see some of those scenes where they bury them at sea.
You think by seeing scenes like that, we'll have a better understanding or appreciation of the price that was paid for our freedom?
Oh, definitely. If you kind of see that sacrifice that they gave, you appreciate things more.
If that doesn't underscore the real meaning of Memorial Day, I don't know what does. 8 days after Al Skerritt passed away, we also lost Leon Christensen at the age of 93. Leon served on the battleship USS Texas, which was shelling German positions overlooking Omaha Beach early in the morning of June 6, 1944. He also survived some close calls a couple weeks later.
We had two planes on our ship that we catapulted off. They were sightseeing planes. They weren't armed or anything. And the spotter planes is what we used them for. We sent them up, and they kind of looked at what the situation was, and they thought that it was secured. We've been bombarding for quite a while. So they sent us in pretty close. We went in within, I don't know the exact distance, but I would imagine within 6 or 8 miles of shore. And then all of a sudden, the Germans all came to life. I was sitting on the deck at the time, I went up on top. All of a sudden, we heard these splashes in the water, and we knew we were being shelled, so we got to our battle station. They sounded battle stations. We took two hits, one on the conning tower, which we lost a man there, and wounded several. The conning tower, in case you wonder or don't know, is the main tower that goes up on the ship, and decks are built around it. The shell hit just below one of the decks. And my friend, his name was Christensen, got killed on that one. And then a while later, we took another shell, went through the hull of our ship, and landed in a compartment right close to where I was. We didn't know about it, and it didn't explode.
Mm-hmm.
It was a dud. Had it exploded, I probably wouldn't be talking to you today.
Yeah. And in fact, you can see that unexploded shell, and I think maybe your son did when he visited the USS Texas. It's on display. Where else but the Lone Star State? So let's talk about this. Just to clarify for people, this is a couple weeks after D-Day, almost 3 weeks after. And while I mentioned D-Day, so much has been written about June 6th. And there were so many elements of it. You've got the planes overhead, the paratroopers and gliders behind enemy lines, the guys who are hitting the shore, and obviously all of you on over 700 ships between the Americans and the British that morning. But the moniker that has stuck is the longest day.
Mm-hmm.
Did it feel that way to you?
Yeah, I guess it did in a way. Again, I'm just a young kid yet. I didn't take anything as serious as an older person might have. I wasn't scared.
Mm-hmm.
I wasn't scared. I don't know how to explain how I felt.
But on that day, there wasn't a whole lot of damage on your ship.
No.
But here you are. No damage, which is pretty incredible considering where you were and what was going on. But here you get a couple weeks later at Cherbourg, and the Germans are hitting your ship. And you mentioned that the first casualty, the first to die on your ship, was named Christensen, mm-hmm. Kristen Christensen.
Mm-hmm.
And you actually knew him? You
guys, very well, yes.
Because of the common surname? Is that what brought you together?
No, I could be.
Yeah?
Could be. We met each other. We weren't close buddies or anything, but acquaintances.
Well, and so often I talk to veterans, and they all have moments where, you know, it could have been me. Maybe I wouldn't have come home, and you just described them for me. But it seems to me that when one of the guys on your ship dies, it's a friend of yours, and he has the same name as you, how do you not feel like that could have been me?
It really hurt.
Was there anything that helped you deal with that?
Well, as working with the corpsman, I had to go up and help get him down. And a couple of the wounded from this deck that had been blown up. So the shell hit just below and it exploded up, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And it snapped his legs off.
Mm.
Bled to death. He got taken down, but he never recovered. But the feeling was terrible to see a friend like that. But it would have been the same, I think, for anybody to see one of your buddies
Yeah.
go down.
Well, and I've got to imagine
You've never experienced anything like this. I mean, you've done dirty jobs on the dairy, but coming face to face with this kind of carnage.
Yep, that's right. It was really an experience.
How'd you deal with that? How did you keep evacuating the wounded and carrying on with your tasks in the midst of that?
Well, it's just something that we knew we had to do. And I think it's a frame of mind. I saw guys that were, you know, that I thought were real tough sailors and actually break down under fire, especially at Cherbourg when we got hit and lost it, you know. And some way I was able to be calm about it. And when I saw those shells splashing in the water, and then they sound GQ, which is get to general quarters right away. I think I was fairly calm about it. To say I wasn't scared, I guess I was afraid a little bit, but not too much. It's just something we knew we had to do.
And I read one account that said that there were about 65 near misses.
Yes.
Shells that almost hit the Texas.
Almost hit us. We only got hit by two.
And then there's the one that didn't explode.
Yeah.
And, I mean, if you want to talk about a close call, this is a 240-millimeter shell.
Yes.
That's a big sucker. And you said that the room where it was found was close to where you had
been?
Yes,
very close. Almost in the next, almost as I remember the layout there in the next compartment down from where we were.
And you were in there when it hit?
Yeah. That's where I was, waiting to be called. Because I didn't know when it hit because it was a dud and it didn't go off. And I didn't make that much. But it hit above the water line. So it didn't, no water came in the ship.
No one even knew it was there until later.
No, later.
Yeah.
No.
That's got to be quite the realization when you see that.
Yes. And I got called up to help on the deck up above with my friend Christensen and a few others that got wounded.
When this exchange is finally over, when the firing finally stops, were you still busy with caring for wounded? What were you doing?
I was working with the meds on that as long as I could. And then they got transferred off our ship. And I don't know what happened to the man that I carried down. I know that he was badly hurt in his eye area. He had his hands in his eyes like this, and he was unconscious. He was a ranger.
And you had to carry him to be transferred to?
They brought him out in a small boat to alongside our ship. There were several, but we brought out a couple, three or four maybe. And I got this one, and we carried him down to what we call sick bay on the ship, but it was our hospital down there. That probably affected me a lot because I thought, here he is, he's unconscious, he can't talk, but he has his hands over his eyes like this, like that. I didn't know whether he had his eyes hit or what, but we delivered him down and came back up. I don't know how many were brought on, but I know that the one that I carried was a ranger.
So you're carrying all this out, and you're carrying this wounded man. I'm sure there's all kinds of emotions running through your brain, but you just have to keep going and keep working. When did you find out that this image of you carrying a wounded ranger on your ship in June of 44 was in the Saturday Evening Post for the whole country to see?
I didn't know until the doctor, the head doctor on our ship, told me. And he's the one that always told me every time I went into battle after that, that you'd look my photogenic best. Making fun of me, of course. But that's when I found out, probably a few days later, he said that my picture was in the Saturday Evening Post, and my parents got the picture, too. I think it was even present in the Fresno Bee. Anyway, my parents knew about it. So that's an experience to have your picture put in a magazine like that. They didn't mention my name in the picture.
Sure. When you look at it now, what does it make you think
of? Memories, lots of memories, Paul. You know, this happened over 70 years ago. It's just hard to believe that 70 years have passed since then. It's just, and you know, as I get older, I think more about it than I did when I was young. I didn't even want to talk about it that much. But now these memories are all very vivid. As if I was just there right now. It's a feeling that you never forget, I guess.
He never did forget, and we won't forget him. That was the late Leon Christensen. You can link to his full interview, as you can for all of the vets we'll remember today, at hometownheroesradio.com. And this special Memorial Day edition will return right after this.
This is Hometown Heroes.
celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, marking Memorial Day weekend 2018 by reflecting on some of the amazing veterans who have left us in the past year. Their stories live on and always will, and Chet Thomason had quite a story. He passed away in September, 2 days shy of his 95th birthday, but that was just months after a group of football players from Fresno City College in California had carried him down, literally picked him up and carried him down to the famed Crystal Cave in Sequoia and Kings Canyon National Parks. 77 years earlier, Chet had helped lay explosives that made that cave accessible for tourists. And we would never know that story if Chet hadn't survived the sinking of his ship, the destroyer USS Monson, on November 13th, 1942.
Friday the 13th, I figured out my lucky day.
Well, I guess you can look at different parts of that day and say it was both lucky and unlucky.
Yep, I lived through it, so my lucky day.
Well, you guys got torpedoed.
Right.
In the middle of the night.
Right.
Where were you when that happened?
I was in my bunk.
Well, that'll wake you up.
You're right. Prepare to abandon ship. I saw a 10-foot 4x4 out there, and I told the other guys that were with me. There was three guys. I was just making for that log, for that 4x4. That's what we did.
So you jumped in and you swam for the 4x4?
Right.
And you made it?
Right.
How long did you end up being in the water?
14 hours.
14 hours in the water?
Yeah. I had one shark come up to take a bite of me, and I saw his teeth. I took both feet and kicked him out in the side of the face and left me alone.
And you were all alone at that point?
Right.
So you guys are floating on this 4x4, and you see sharks in the water.
Yep.
What does that do to you? I think most people would be scared out of their minds.
Well, I had Navy shoes on, so I drew back in my both feet, and I kicked him in the side of the face.
Mm-hmm. What's going through your mind for 14 hours in the water?
I don't know. Don't remember.
Did you think you were going to die?
Nope.
Why not?
I was too young and invincible. My body was invincible.
Your ship wasn't.
Well, I was.
Did you see your ship go under?
Yep, it was on fire. Burned.
You're one of the last guys left from that ship. How do you think the guys who died that night should be remembered? What should people know about who they were and the kind of guys they were?
There was somebody's son, and somebody will say, well, I had a son that died in the war.
Another haunting reminder of what Memorial Day is all about. That was Chet Thomason, who passed away in September, 2 days shy of his 95th birthday. John Cardinale was 96 when we met him last year. He had kept his World War II story secret for decades because he was part of the OSS, predecessor to the CIA, operating behind enemy lines in Europe during the war and having to consider the ugly prospect of what he would do if captured.
I was given a medical bag and two cyanide tablets in case I would capture in a bad position. All that, take a cyanide tablet, you're out. You're dead.
And you were prepared to kill yourself if it came to that.
Yeah, right. Been the condition at the time, you know. But after the war was over, I got them. I took them away. It was scary. I was really scared many, many times. They're all scared. No matter who you are, they're all scared. You live from day to day. There's always something new every day, and I felt sorry for all these kids that got killed. Thank God I pulled through it, and I came out of my right senses. I still thank God for what I've done, and being alive at 96 years old. So you never know how much longer I've got. I know I'm one of the few left.
How hard was it for all those years? I mean, your book is called 65 Years of Secrecy. That's a long time. How often over the course of those 65 years did you wish you could have told someone? Did you want to be able to talk about what you did?
I was dying to tell some, especially close friends, my buddies of mine, golf, playing golf and all that here in Monterey, fishermen, where I was a contractor, a painting contractor, an employer, and never told my men anything. I just as an employer, you know. I was just dying to tell, but I held up, thank God, and nobody knew until 2008. Then it went public by the National Archives, and that's it.
Yeah, so the National Archives releases this. All the names of people who worked with the OSS. Some of those are famous names, movie stars, famous chefs, politicians, Supreme Court justices, and Johnny Cardinale. He's right there on the list. So was that a relief for you when that happened?
It was a relief. Boy, sure. It's just like letting out gas. That was quite a relief. Anyway, it's quite a decent. I was proud of myself for what I did, and a lot of people wouldn't believe it. Like I say, there's only a few left. You probably count them with your fingers on your hand. That's how many's left.
John Cardinale passed away November 5th at the age of 96, and 2 weeks later, we lost Jim McCrory, too. Jim was with the 2nd Marine Division for the Battle of Guadalcanal.
We were going to assault Tanambogo, and they wanted all automatic weapons on top of this hill to fire over on Tanambogo, which was about 400 yards away and connected with what they called the causeway, which was a road that had been coral dredged up and piled up and made a road between the two.
So again, these two islands are both in the harbor.
Right,
they're connected
inside
by
the
this
harbor.
Little causeway.
Connected by this little causeway.
So you're firing from a high point
over
on Yavutu over to Tanambogo.
Right, and it was so far that my tracers were actually burning out before they got there. I couldn't aim or anything, but I could do like a garden hose. I could watch my tracers and tell where my bullets were going. So anyhow, I was up there for a few minutes firing, and there was people like me, and there had been a Jap observation point up there where they had dug a pit about 8 by 8 and built a roof over it. And unknown to us, there was a Japanese flag on top of that roof. And there was a squadron of SBDs from the Enterprise bombing Tanambogo, just circling around and one would peel off and bomb and come up. And this guy, I looked up, and I saw him point right at me. And I saw that 500-pound bomb detached from his airplane. So instead of getting up and running, he was probably 1,200 foot high or something. I just got on my hands and knees, and I went backwards as fast as I could go down that hill. And before the bomb went off, I must have got maybe this much of the curve of the hill between me and the bomb. And it went off, and everything turned black. And I thought, I remember so clearly my thinking. I thought, well, I'm dead. Then it turned gray. I thought, well, I'm not dead. And I looked up, and I could see 2x4 and pieces of tin and stuff circling in the air. And I thought, well, those will kill me when they come down. But they didn't, except that I was stone deaf. Mm. However, that bomb lit right on top of the roof of that building. We had two complete sets of air-cooled 30 caliber Browning machine guns with their crews in there. And those people, we didn't find bodies. They were gone, just totally vanished. And then there were several other men wounded, but I was not. As I say, I just had this shock, this deafness and concussion. And 500-pound bomb is this big around and that high, you know, they're not a little bitty thing.
Very destructive.
They'll sink a ship.
And so everybody listening understands here. So you had taken this position.
Yes.
Not knowing that above you is flying a Japanese flag.
No, I did not know that. So, nor did anyone else, or we'd have got it down.
You couldn't see it from where you were
coming. No, it was on. There was a corrugated metal roof over this observation point, and this flag was flat on this corrugated iron roof.
How did you guys find out about the flag?
Because somebody found it later. It didn't totally destroy.
They found it in the rubble.
Found it in the rubble.
So
still on some of the metal.
So no one can fault this SBD dive bomber pilot for seeing a Japanese flag and
we did not fault him, even though, you know, it's called friendly fire.
Yep.
We did not fault the man. But the instant that happened, they all vanished in a flash because I'm sure the others were saying, hey, the ones who knew, but we did not fault him.
The story you're telling really underscores how a real minute detail can have a huge life or death impact on people.
Correct.
No one had any idea that flag's up there.
Had no idea.
And you say those bodies were disintegrated.
They were gone.
How many people do you think were killed?
In that little group were 8, and there were probably 3 more killed up and down the top of that little hill. Then there were a lot who were like me, you know, were shocked or deafened or whatever. In fact, this friend of mine who maybe the rest of the time there was never more than 3 or 4 foot from me. When these people were killed, this is horrible. I'll tell you some horrible things, make you sick. Blood flew. There's a lot of blood in 8 or 10 people. And this friend of mine was drenched in this blood. He was as shocked as I was. And he got a few splinters of shrapnel in his arms. But he wasn't really injured. And when the corpsman came up there, they saw him all bloody. And they asked him, you know, what's wrong with you? And he said, I'm okay, you know. But they thought he was out of his mind from the bomb. So they forced him onto a stretcher and took him down to the aid station where they cleaned him up and they found out there was nothing wrong with him. Then they chewed him for having used 4 stretcher bearers and taking up the doctor's time and stuff.
Even though he told him he was
Even though he kept trying to tell him he was okay. But would you believe a man drenched in blood or if a bomb had detonated maybe 30 foot from his head was okay?
Well, and how far were you from where it detonated?
Probably 25, 30 foot.
And correct me if I'm wrong, but my interpretation of what you've shared with me is that by any reasonable expectation, you should not have survived that.
I should not, no. No, it was by the grace of God, by scooting backwards on my hands and knees, I probably got that much of the curve of the mountain between me and the bomb.
Yeah, and like a foot or so. Uh-huh.
Yeah, if you get that much, it will throw the impact up. Or if I hadn't have had that, I would have disintegrated like the rest of them.
You had about a foot of overhang that redirected the shrapnel.
I would estimate that, yes.
Uh-huh.
Because this all took place in seconds. When I looked up and I could see the bomb turn loose,
yeah.
You know, it's like somebody throws a rock at you. You know where it's going to hit. Well, I knew it was going to hit me.
Mm-hmm.
I could see it. So and there was nothing I could do. I couldn't get up and run. I didn't have time. So that's where I said I scooted backwards. I only had seconds to do it, so I couldn't have got more than 25 or 30 foot down the mountain. So I'm only guessing.
So your life is spared.
Yes.
But you told us you couldn't hear anything.
Not for 2 or 3 days.
2 or 3 days. Mm-hmm. How did you communicate for those 2 or 3 days?
We just didn't.
Did you get any nicks or scratches or anything else from it?
I did not.
Nothing. Wow.
And the whole time on Guadalcanal and everywhere else, outside of this eye being damaged by the front sight of a Springfield rifle, I never got a scratch. However, there was fungus and stuff so bad that we all had terrible rotten spots that went clear to the bone on us. Mm-hmm. Ulcers. They were so, if you'd get a scratch on your leg, it would turn into an ulcer. I've still got dimples on my legs from
I don't want to dwell on, you know, this horrible stuff, but I just want to understand what it was like to be you. Again, you're 20 years old.
Yeah.
You just almost died. You can't hear a thing. You don't know if you're ever going to hear anything again. And a bunch of the guys that you had been there with just got vaporized by one of your own bombs.
Yes.
How do you handle that? How do you deal with that?
Some people can and some people can't. I happen to be one who could. However, not as well as I thought. If I had something to occupy me all the time, I could deal with it all my life. But my first wife was a schizophrenic, and taking care of her occupied me completely. But when I lost her, I began to get terrible attacks of PTSD because I was not totally occupied.
So when your mind has time to wander, that's where it goes.
When my mind has time to wander, it goes to all those dead faces looking at me and that sort of thing.
Wow. And you're speaking in the present tense. This is not something that you're over your past. You know that you're still susceptible to these flashbacks and these bouts of PTSD.
Yes, I am. And this is a very worrisome thing for me about the young men of today, because I know that these young men who were in Iraq and there are not over that at all, just because they're out of there.
You know how many times you came close to not coming home?
Oh, and dozens.
And you know 7,000, more than 7,000 Americans died in the Battle of Guadalcanal. 406,000 in the war. All these years later, how do we need to remember those who died?
Just as young men who did what they felt was correct for their country to the best of their ability, and try to remember that they were young, virile men who had everything to give to the country, and they weren't here anymore to give it. The country was at a big loss for not having them.
Again, those veterans we're remembering today left us with what is so important to zero in on this Memorial Day weekend. That was Jim McCrory, who passed away in November at the age of 96. 2 weeks later, Jonas Hofer finished his race. 73 years earlier, Jonas had survived the torpedoing of the cruiser USS Houston.
When I came to in the water, there were about 25 of us in the water and that. And you'll think this is funny, and I think it is too, is that we started singing some hymns. And the hymns I remember we sang, one of them was, "There Shall Be Showers of Blessing." Now, why would you sing a song like that? It just seems crazy to me. Why would you sing "There's"? But I guess because most of the sailors knew that song. We sang that and some other hymns and that there in the water. And then it got dark and we got parted. And pretty soon we weren't close. And Dyke and myself, we tied ourselves together with our belts. And we were in the water. And then the next day, the sun came out. During the night, we saw some ships come close. And we were afraid at first they'd go over us, but they didn't. But we were afraid to yell out because we didn't know if they're Japanese or ours, because there were so many ships in the air, Japanese and that. And we were pretty close to Formosa there, too, you know, 80 miles about that time. They figure that during those 2 days, we were towed about 80 miles on the water.
Couple questions. You said when you came to in the water, so did you, and you said you don't remember when you went off the ship, did you get off the ship under your own power, or were you blown off the ship, or you don't know?
I don't know. I think I got off my own, but I can't remember going over the side of the ship. And then it was after I was in the water, Dyke swam up to me, and I recognized him. So we tied ourselves together with our belts, and then we wanted to stay together.
And did you have a Mae West or any kind of flotation device?
I had two of them. I had a Mae West, and then I had the other one, which is a rubber one that has a little hand. You pull it, and it blows up, and it goes underneath you. The Mae West, after 3 hours, was worthless. It was taking us down that night. And so we both took our Mae West and just dropped them. They sunk, actually. But these rubber ones we had, those were good. Those stayed. And they, if they went down and had a leak in them, they also had something you could blow them. And that's what kept us up till the next day, yeah.
How many hours were you in the water?
Between 14 and 16. I don't know exactly when we went in. I know I was picked up at about 10 o'clock next morning. It was about 6 o'clock in the evening, while the sun was going down, when we got that second torpedo. And I just don't know, like I say, I cannot reckon at all of when I went in the water. But I know there, because Dyke swam up, and we swam together and tied ourselves together, and we sang these songs in the water. I know that much. And then during the night, we got parted, you know. In the morning when we got picked up, there was nobody close to us. And the USS Grayson was still in a battle then. The ships were still fighting there again. They'd gotten into battle again. And what they did with our ship, they towed it as bait for the Japanese planes to come out, and then our battleships and those would, and our pilots would shoot them down. But they missed this one Betty that came in, saw our oil slick, and came in the side and gave us the next torpedo.
I've talked to a few guys who have had to abandon ship and who have had to survive the water for some time. And in different spots, there were different hazards of the water. What did you see? What did you experience floating in the water? I mean, were there things burning around you? Were there things to hold on to? Did you have to fear sharks at all? What did you have to deal with?
There was a lot of wood and stuff and seats and different things in the water. There was a lot of that stuff in the water, floating metal and some metal and that there. See, the tornado had went through there about 3 days before that, and so we had white caps go over our heads all the time, and you was wet continue. But the water temperature was 87 degrees. So it was warm when you started out. But by the next day, when you'd been in it over 12 hours, I think I was in it, I'd say 14 to 16 hours, somewhere in between. Yeah. I was so weak from being in the water so long. And of course, we hadn't eaten in maybe 30 hours that I couldn't even climb the ropes on the ship. What the Grayson did is they couldn't stop, because then they'd get a torpedo. So they kept going, but they put a boat. And the boat took one circle, picked up eight of us. And then while they were picking us up and we was getting on, a torpedo went under the ship. The sailors said it had been set a little too deep, maybe for a battle wagon or aircraft carrier. So then when we got up, of course, and got on, two sailors came down and got me under the arms and brought me over the, because I couldn't climb. I was just so tired and that. And then Dyke says, well, let's thank the Lord. So we knelt down there and prayed. And there were about 100 sailors around us, plus officers and that. And I can remember when we prayed, they were just all quiet. There was really respect.
Anyone who ever had the privilege of meeting Jonas Hofer had nothing but respect for him. Again, you can access the full stories of any of these late veterans we honor today at hometownheroesradio.com. And our Memorial Day special continues after this.
Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea. You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, observing Memorial Day weekend by reflecting on veterans who have left us since this time last year. On January 8th, we lost George Poplin. When he shared his story here 5 months earlier, it generated quite a response from people who had taken his high school typing class. They marveled at how well he typed when they learned how severely injured his hands were while serving with the 2nd Infantry Division in Europe.
On Christmas Eve, I went to the chaplain's service, and I promised the Lord that if I got home, I'd serve him the rest of my life. That took a while for that to catch on, but I finally caught on after I got home. When I got hit, I had on 2 overcoats and heavy gloves.
That was your standard?
It was that day. It's cold. I'd been on guard duty, and it was extra cold. And that shrapnel went right through there, half an inch layer, just took out bone and everything, nerves. And then on this other arm, it went through, took out the bone. So I had to have a bone graft, and it's broken.
So we understand. This was in the morning? When this happened? And you and one other guy are standing next to each other?
Well, we're walking down to the Jeep with Mormite can in each hand.
Uh-huh.
That's what they brought the food in. Kept the food hot.
Right.
And it knocked me down.
Where did it hit in relation to where the two of you were?
It must have hit just in between us. We were not close together because you didn't dare do that. But as I went down, I lost my helmet down into a ditch. And I said to a couple of guys that were there, not ours, I didn't know them.
Mm-hmm.
I said, would you get my helmet for me? I lost it off in the ditch. And I was bleeding, of course, down the sleeves. And they said, you don't need a helmet. You need to get back to the aid station. They hailed a Jeep and got me back to the aid station.
What do you think would have happened to you if they didn't?
No telling. I'd have bled to death, probably.
Instead, he went on to touch the lives of so, so many, including yours truly. That was George Poplin. The same week that he passed away, we also lost one of the WASPs from World War II. When I asked Doris Wanty what she was most proud of, her time as a Women's Air Force service pilot rolled instantly off her tongue.
The wings I got when I graduated.
You still have them?
Yes, I do.
Did you feel like you were doing something important for your country?
No. Not at the time, I didn't.
You feel that way now?
Yeah, they've told us that so many times that you feel like maybe you were doing something important.
You finally believe them?
I don't know if I believe them. It was a good feeling to be a graduate of the WASP. I liked it very much. I like flying. Nothing else compares to it, and it's a wonderful feeling.
A feeling we trust has been met and exceeded for Doris since her passing in January. When we heard Doris's story, we also introduced you to her husband, Mike, who left us a month after Doris. Mike served on the destroyer USS Lardner. Are there some times that you look back on when you were on the Lardner and you remember what happened and you can picture it in your mind and you ask yourself, how did I survive that? Or maybe say, well, hey, I was pretty fortunate to survive that.
There is one. And I don't like to talk about it, and if I do tell you, I may crack in talking about it, but I'll tell you, it happened at Christmas time. This is why I hate Christmas.
Still today, 70 years later, you hate Christmas.
In a way, I don't know if I can tell you or not.
Mm.
It happened at Bougainville. We helped the Marines go ashore, and then the bodies started coming back, and they would come back in baskets, and one of the... You shouldn't have done this. This boy they put on the wardroom table, he had no arms, no legs, and he was burned over most of his body. And all we could do was give him morphine, and he wanted to hear White Christmas all the time. It was a record to play over and over and over and over.
And it took us about 10 hours, I guess, to get to a forward hospital on Vela La Vela. And the doctor said to me, he says, "I won't let him die, Mike. I'll get him ashore." And he did, but he died once he got there. But he didn't die on the ship. I've always felt bad. I never got his name or his father and mother. I've always wanted to write to her. He was about 17, Marine, nice young guy.
It's okay. I'm sorry, Mike.
You don't realize. Happens if I ever think about it. And at Christmas time, it's double. They keep playing White Christmas. I've gotten used to it. But to talk about it, it's different.
But over the years, if you're somewhere and White Christmas comes
you
on...
You never can forget it.
Another reminder of the price of freedom we observe this Memorial Day. Francis Asbury knew all about that. His older brother Leon was a P-47 pilot shot down and killed in action on his 129th mission in Europe. For the younger brother, a flight in a war-weary Navy B-24 on December 19, 1944 nearly ended his life.
Well, we were out probably a little over 300 miles from Hawaii. The number one engine caught on fire, and we're going to have to go down. And I'll tell you a story, and you can... I had a real good buddy on there, and when we found out we were going to go down, we all had life jackets. And he came up to the flight deck, and he said he didn't have one. I mean, we didn't have a spare. We looked around and couldn't find another one, and later on we did. And instead of staying at the radio... I had my second radioman get on, and I took the life jacket back to him in the back, and I was standing up when the plane hit. So I have no idea how I got out. I must have gone out head first.
So you have no idea how you made it from inside the tail of that plane to the water?
No idea.
Where were you when you came to?
I was in the water, and I saw the life raft, and Red was in it, and I was able to manipulate and get close enough, or he was getting close enough to me, to where he could pull me in.
Wow.
Actually, really being hurt, I was the only one on the plane that was hurt. I'll take that back. We lost 8 guys out of 15.
Oh, you had 15 that day?
Yeah. We had 4 guys that went over aboard ship, and they had not had in their 4 hours of flight pay. You got to fly 4 hours a month in order to earn flight pay. So they went up in order to get 4 hours.
Oh.
Yeah, 3 of them went down with the plane.
Uh-huh.
And one of them got out.
So of the 15 on board, 8 are killed. And you come to, you're floating in the water. I mean, if you had taken longer to come to, you might not be here, huh? You had a life jacket that was keeping you afloat?
I had a life jacket on.
I mean, did you even know what had happened or who you were or where you were?
Oh, yeah. I knew what was going on, and I knew we were down and that we were in trouble.
So you see Red in the raft, and you're able to kind of paddle your way over?
Mm-hmm.
But you're hurt. You can already feel that there are some injuries.
Oh, yeah. I've got my face smashed in. I can't see out of my right eye. I've got a broken arm, compound fracture of this arm, and I lost a lot of teeth.
Lost a lot of blood, I bet.
Probably, yeah. Lost a lot of blood, but mainly it was my face. And this compound fracture of this bone and this bone here to where?
Around your eye, the orbital bone?
Uh-huh.
Wow.
So my eye sunk down, but there's compound fracture of both of them. And my nose, my upper jaw was shattered, my lower jaw was shattered.
So basically, your face looks like it got sledgehammered.
Yeah.
Could you feel all that pain, or were you kind of numb to some of it?
Actually, I wasn't numb, really. The only thing that hurt was my arm. Anytime I moved it or anybody touched it, it hurt. As far as my face and all these bones that were broken in there, I had no pain.
Wow.
It's amazing.
So you get to the raft, and Red helps you into it?
Oh, yeah.
And can you see anybody else?
See the other guys hanging on the side.
Of the raft?
There were always 3 of us in the raft. I was in the middle and one on each end. It was only a 2-man life raft, really.
But they put you in the middle because you were the most severely injured.
Yeah. The other guys hung on the side.
Uh-huh.
And then they all took turns switching around over a couple of days.
And what time of day was it when you crashed?
Very nice day.
What? Middle of the day, like afternoon or something?
I would say very early afternoon.
Uh-huh.
Right afternoon.
I imagine you had some perspective on this. because you've already done a whole tour in the Pacific flying these patrols where you're looking for enemy ships and you're looking for submarines, and I imagine occasionally you were looking for downed American airplanes, right?
Yes.
Now you guys are a downed American airplane.
You're right.
So you're dependent on someone who had been doing what you were doing to find you.
Hopefully.
Well, and that's my question. How much hope did you have? Knowing what you'd seen and what you were familiar with, did you think you guys would get picked up?
Absolutely not. When you're 300 miles from land in a two-man life raft, three-man life raft, you don't expect to get picked up. You're just lucky when you get spotted.
And he was blessed to live another 74 years until his passing in January of this year. 2 months later, we lost a vet I had the privilege of growing quite close to after first interviewing him in 2011. Richard Christensen was a Purple Heart recipient who went on to become a pastor and a longtime VA chaplain.
One of the frequent verses of scripture that was quoted was from Psalm 91, where it says, "He shall give his angels charge over you." I received such a letter from a very good and godly lady in our church the same day that I heard that my cousin and one of my close friends had been killed in action. My cousin at St. Lo and the other friend, John Friesma, he always loved cars. He was a farmer, but he loved cars and tractors and everything, and he was a tank person when he was over there, and he was killed just about the time that I was facing my own problems. So at that point, you read that scripture, and you realize that there's a reality for yourself, but there's also the fact that some people are going to die, and the Lord knows the path for each of us, and I think you learn in moments like that that we don't know everything. Mm-hmm. So many, many things are in the counsels of God and nowhere else.
It sounds like maybe you're 20 years old, so I'm not going to put words in your mouth and tell you you were ready to go at that point, but it sounds like it gave you some peace that you weren't in control, but somebody was.
Yeah, I think that's true. You pray every day. You pray when you're going through the ordeal. But you have to find a way of dealing with reality and knowing that even as you pray, you may die. Mm-hmm. I had that experience when myself and a man named Lieutenant Posner, 22-year-old graduate of the University of Kansas, he had come in as a replacement, and I was with him on, I think, the second battle that he entered, and he and I went up in the second story of a house. An artillery shell from German hit in a tree outside the house there, and just one shard of shrapnel went straight through his heart, and he was gone. And you realize in a moment like that every moment of the day when you're in combat could be your last.
Dick Christensen took his last breath on March 22nd, eulogized beautifully by his adopted son, Clyde, a longtime NFL assistant coach. In April, we lost Eddie Fail, who had been assumed dead more than once during World War II, including when he spent 2 weeks stranded on a tiny Pacific island after having to crash land his TBF Avenger.
Well, we had a routine to take the raft out, put it on the beach every night to collect the water. Incidentally, that's drinking water coming out of life raft stinks.
A little rubbery plastic?
Yeah. But anyway, one particular morning, we went out to pick up the life raft, and we see a plane coming straight at us. I forgot what kind of a plane it was, but from the front, that thing looked like a Zero. And we all scrambled back for cover, and as it comes up, we see the star, we rush out and wave. And so he sent the ward out, and the USS Gamble picked us up.
Something tells me if you were gone that long that the members of your squadron might have suspected that you had died.
No, I was reported dead. And I still think that's why I got the Navy course.
Well, it was a little more than that. The Navy mentioned his courageous fighting spirit and fearless devotion to duty maintained with utter disregard for his own personal safety. That's from his citation for the Navy Cross, a decoration exceeded only by the Medal of Honor. Eddie Fail died April 6th and will be buried at Arlington National Cemetery. Also last month, the community of South Bend, Indiana was stunned to learn of the passing of Paul Davis because he had been so active in giving back to his hometown even well into his 90s. When he shared his story on Hometown Heroes, he recalled liberating a concentration camp in Europe.
We didn't realize it was near as bad as what it was until we did liberate that one camp.
Yeah.
And boy, when we let them people go free, they were running.
If they could, if they were able, and a lot of them weren't.
Right.
And you just showed me some photos that you took there.
Yes, with my little brownie box camera.
Brownie box camera. And I'm not trying to be melodramatic, but this is the truth. You told me as you were showing me those pictures that your children have never seen them.
Right.
It's more than 70 years ago.
You never have seen them, dude. She didn't want to look at them tonight.
Well, and I don't blame anyone for not wanting to look. But there was a reason that you took them.
Right. I never thought anything like that could happen to a human being. And it was terrible to have to see that.
So many lives to remember this Memorial Day. That was Paul Davis, and I have two more men to recognize before we run out of time here. On May 3rd, Bob Barney finished his journey at the age of 98. The upcoming 74th anniversary of D-Day will be the first time since that longest day that this paratrooper won't be here to tell us what it felt like to jump behind enemy lines in the pre-dawn hours of June 6th, 1944. And I was dumb enough to ask Bob if he was scared.
Oh, boy. Yes, huh. I was scared. And I didn't get scared until after I hit the ground. It's a lonely world out there.
I would imagine it could be a little overwhelming.
Yeah, but being at, I think, the average individual, at Yankee Ingenuity, you had a job that you were supposed to do, and it was over there somewhere, so you start headed for it.
Mm-hmm.
That's the way it worked out.
Well, when you think back on all of it, all those days that you endured as a paratrooper, certainly those bitterly cold days at the Battle of the Bulge, when you think back on all of it, what are you most thankful for and what are you most proud of?
Surviving. You know, you look at that's the part when you think about what took place, all these guys that made it home like I did, that was an accomplishment.
Mm-hmm.
We survived.
Bob Barney was certainly a survivor and an inspiration to anyone who had the privilege of knowing him. And you can say the same for Leo Weil, who passed away on VE Day, May 8th. He had survived some close calls during the invasion of North Africa and served as a crew chief for P-40 Warhawks with the 33rd Fighter Group.
The first time I was really hit by something is when my pilot was killed. That I couldn't take. He was up with other planes. And when he came back, there were ME-109s above. Our planes were in the sun, and they didn't see him, and they lost him. He was shot down, I was told, and he used his parachute. He was killed coming down in the parachute, and I felt terrible. I wouldn't get out of that place I was sleeping in for a couple of days.
I don't imagine you were keeping count, but you just heard from 15 different World War II veterans who left us since last Memorial Day. The words they left us with, those haunting memories, underscore what Memorial Day is all about. Counting up the cost, measuring the price of freedom, and then doing everything we can to make sure it was not paid in vain. So that's where we'll finish today. Thank you so much for listening. I'm Paul Leffler, hoping you'll remember on Memorial Day and every day that freedom is not free.